broadcast. "So it's up to you," Jordan said earnestly, looking squarely into Aditi's handheld phone, propped up on the coffee table in front of him, "to decide what we human beings should do to help the people who will be wiped out unless we act to save them." In the three-dimensional viewer across their hotel room, he saw himself sitting in front of a backdrop of the swirling star clouds of the Milky Way galaxy. "The people of these other worlds do not look human, of course, but they are intelligent, and they have as much a right to life as you and I. We can't just sit here idly and let them die. That would be inhuman." The holographic scene changed from Jordan's intent face to a view of a planet in space, with two large moons hanging nearby. "This is one of the worlds in danger," Jordan said. "It orbits a faint red star nearly 200 light-years from Earth. That means that it will take 400 years for a spacecraft traveling at 50% of light speed to reach it." The view shifted again. Now it showed greenly forested mountains with sparkling streams tumbling down their flanks, and in the distance, graceful towers that resembled minarets. "These views were taken from robotic spacecraft that surveyed this planet many centuries ago. The people who live here have not yet discovered electricity or even steam power, but they have built a civilization that exists in harmony with their environment." The scene shifted to show the city more closely. Its streets were busy with traffic. Creatures that looked curiously like oversized salamanders walked on their hind legs, dressed in colorful draperies. Four-legged reptilian animals pulled wagons. The city looked to Jordan's eyes like a medieval community, prosperous and busy. "They have no idea that the death wave is hurtling toward them at the speed of light. If we sent a rescue mission to this world, it would barely get there before the death wave kills every living thing on it." Jordan saw his own face once more in the viewer. "If we don't act, and act soon, those people will be totally destroyed by the death wave, and so will the intelligent creatures of five other worlds. Can we let them die? Or should we use our strength and our courage to save them? It's up to you to decide." Anita Halleck slapped her hands together with a vicious crack, and her holographic viewer went dark. Turning to Gilda Nordquist, sitting off to one side of her desk, Halleck said, "We're going to have to get rid of that alien bitch."
"Kill her?"
Nordquist asked, slightly alarmed.
"Freeze her, kill her, send her to the other end of the galaxy. As long as she's with Kel, he can thumb his nose at us."
Nordquist hesitated for a moment, then said,
"But they're protected by a private security team. And then there's Gandhi's own security forces,
which are a joke."
"Yes, but you can't get at her while they're in the habitat. You can't just invade a sovereign territory."
Halleck's frown slowly morphed into a vicious smile.
"Then we'll simply have to end our isolation of Gandhi and allow Kel and his wife to return to Earth."
Nordquist nodded.
"Plenty of would-be assassins here.
Talk to Rudy Castiglione. He's got a score to settle with the two of them."
Nick Matrenko watched Kel's appearance over the 3D viewer in the jail's common room, with Rachel and Dee Dee sitting on either side of him. The three of them were treated almost like royalty by the other inmates. In a makeshift community of felons, where social rank was decided by the seriousness of one's crime, attempted murder was practically like royalty. The jailhouse population of sneak thieves, con artists, burglars, strong-arm bullies, and rapists treated Nick and his two women with some deference. It helped that almost all the inmates were young, hardly anyone much older than Nick himself. Modern society had weeded out the habitual criminals, the professionals and psychotics, and tucked them away in freezers. Now the police concentrated on catching petty crooks before they graduated to more serious crimes. Once Kel's show was finished, Rachel asked Nick,
"Do you believe him? I mean, about that world being in danger?"
Dee Dee said, "Looked pretty real."
"It could have all been faked," Nick said. "They can make anything look real."
A tall, thatch-haired young man with a strong jaw and pale green eyes leaned into their conversation.
"Looked real to me."
Nick was about to tell him to butt out when the youngster said,
"I used to work in graphics and special effects. It'd take a hell of a lot of effort to make a scene look so real. I mean, even the trees in the background were all different,
No two alike.
How'd you get in here? Nick demanded.
The kid actually blushed. I was faking alibis for guys arrested for burglaries. Showed them miles away from the scene of the crime.
And? Didi asked.
He shrugged. I got careless. Let a couple details slip and the police experts spotted them. So here I am.
Are they going to freeze you? Asked Rachel, real concern in her voice.
Nah, I'm going to a re-education center in Montana. 2 years. Once I get out, I won't be allowed to come back here to New England. I'll have to start my life all over.
That's not so bad, said Didi.
Better than freezing, he agreed.
Nick said, so you think this guy Kell is telling the truth?
Another shrug. From the looks of what he showed, he's either telling the truth or he's got damned better special graphics than I can do.
Carlos Otero was surprised by the call. He was in his office, going over the audience demographics of Kell's broadcast with his staff directors, when his phone announced that the chairwoman of the World Council wished to speak with him. Otero blinked once, then immediately asked his staff people to leave his office.
"We'll continue this later," he said, unable to suppress a smile at the good news they had brought him. Kell's show had been a smashing success. Once the office was cleared, he instructed the phone to put through the connection to Anita Halleck. Without even a nod of greeting, Halleck's first words were,
I can see that it's futile to try to keep Kell from speaking out.
With a cautious smile, Otero said, he has a right to speak his mind.
No matter what the consequences.
That was all decided almost 500 years ago, Otero reminded her. First Amendment to our Constitution.
The world has changed, Carlos,
but not the right to freedom of expression.
For an instant, Halleck looked as if she wanted to debate the idea, but then she composed a smile and said,
I suppose it's futile to restrict him and his wife to Habitat Gandhi.
Carefully, Otero replied,
It looks that way.
Especially with you helping him, she snapped, almost angrily.
Otero spread his hands. I'm just doing my job, Anita.
No matter what the consequences.
Otero thought of a comeback, but buried it and simply smiled at her.
Very well, then, Carlos. I'm going to allow Kell and his wife to return to Earth. If anything happens to them, it will be on your head, not mine.
Otero nodded acceptance, but he thought, if anything happens to them, it will be your doing, bitch. As soon as Halleck cut the connection, Otero put in a call to the Unicorn Agency. He wanted Kell's security team strengthened.